And Finance and Revenue is open. Good morning, everyone. We're going to plow through our agenda in order, technical house bills today, and see where we go. So I'll start off with a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2281. Kyle can give us an update or a briefing on this.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. House Bill 2281 is the first of four bills that come to you from the Department of Revenue this morning. House Bill 2281, I think I'll start with just a brief background first to try to set up what the changes in the bill actually do. But
thank you.
It's important in the property tax system, there are two dates or years, I guess, in which that work congruently with each other. And you have the property tax year, which begins on July 1 and ends on June 30th and works similar to a fiscal year, or follows the same dates of a fiscal year. On the other year that's important to remember is the assessment year, and that follows a calendar year. So the assessment year for, if we're using the current property tax year that we're in right now, is the 16-17 property tax year, but the assessment year related to the 16-17 property tax year is January 1, 2016 through the end of the calendar year. And that's the assessment date as well as that January 1st date. So the assessment date for the current property tax year that we're in would be January 1st, 2016, even though the tax year is 2016-2017. So it's a little, I guess it's important to keep that in mind as it relates to House Bill 2281, which is modifying the timing of forest land disqualification when it's discovered by the county assessor that the land is no longer being used as forest land. So the change in the bill is, under current law, the disqualification, or with the changes in House Bill 2281, the disqualification would be deemed to occur as of January 1 of the assessment date of the assessment year in which the discovery occurs by the county assessor. And right now it's, if I'm remembering this right, it's the assessment date of the tax year. And so that's not necessarily lining up with the dates. The requirement that doesn't change in the bill is the disqualification. There must be notification by the assessor to the property owner by August 15th. So there's really no change on the ground and how this will work when the disqualification will occur. It's more just truing up the dates so that they link up correctly. And I think Department of Revenue has some testimony that can describe some of the background. This may just be some leftover language that didn't get changed when Measure 50 was put in place.
Opens back to Measure 50. Mark Garst.
Oh, that's a long time ago. Exactly.
Yeah. A few years ago.
A little late.
Maybe we could just get right in there.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, Mark Garst with the Oregon Department of Revenue Property Tax Division. So Kyle did a great job of explaining the issue that we're bringing before you today, actually. This is brought on behalf of the Department of Revenue by the governor, and it passed the House unanimously. The Department of Revenue wears a lot of hats. One of the things that we do is we establish the specially assessed value on 7.9 million acres of forest land, and we administer the small tract forest land severance tax and the forest products harvest tax that brings in about $30 million of biennium. We put on a lot of classes and tech groups for the county assessors who actually administer the forest land program, the special assessment program. And then just to back up one step, special assessment is basically there's two types of benefit that you might receive in this property tax system. There's an exemption where you simply don't pay taxes or maybe don't pay on a portion of your property. And then there's special assessment where you're taxed at something other than real market value. And in this case, we're talking about special assessment of forest land. And so you're taxed at the value that the forest land would bring in as forest land, despite the fact that maybe it's being eaten up by home sites or something like that in that particular neighborhood. Maybe you could sell it for more, but you're going to be taxed on what it's worth as forest land without the trees. We'll pick up the value of the trees when you pay your harvest tax down the road, but basically it's what the, you know, what the value would be worth if it was just stumps. So this deals with the disqualification dates, as Kyle explained. The current state of affairs and the state of affairs after this change is that if the assessor lets you know prior to August 15th that that they've discovered that your property is not being used as forest land, they can disqualify you, and then that's effective as of January 1. As Kyle explained, we think that this reference to it says in the statute that they have to notify you prior to August 15th of the tax year. We think that that's a leftover language from prior to Measure 50. And so the statute, as it's written right now, is only effective for 45 days. It's only effective from July 1 to August 15th. What does the assessor do for the rest of the year? We think that they're on firm legal ground as it stands right now, but you have to look at more general statutes. You have to look at some case law. And so it just takes us a long time when we're training folks on how to do this to explain to them what the legal basis is for them to operate outside of that 45-day window. And so really, all that this change is going to do is make it easier for us to explain that. So we met with the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. We met with the Oregon Forest and Industries Council. And I'll tell you what I told them, and that is that this will not change the administration of forest land disqualifications at all. It will not change enforcement of disqualifications. All it's going to do is make it easier for the assessor to explain that process and true up that language that probably should have been corrected at the time of Measure 50. We also have similar disqualification language for farmland special assessment, and this will mirror how that language got changed at the time that Measure 50 passed. So with that, I'm happy to take any questions.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you. We, Mark, you sort of answered my question here, because my first deal is I was trying to figure out, okay, why are we doing this again, since it was so old? And I wrote down Oregon Forest Interest Guide of Small Woodlands, and then I went back and looked at the witness sheet on the other side, and small woodlands and forestry, and nobody said a single word. This is all us legislators and you bureaucrats doing all this stuff. So, and you put on the record. So you're comfortable that forest industries, small woodlands, and the average participant in the forestry sector that follows these things, who are normally in hordes sitting out there, are fine with this bill?
Chair Haas, Senator Boquist.
To your knowledge.
To my knowledge, we've not had anyone concerned with this bill. And as to the why are we here, you know, the Legislative Council does a revisor's bill every year, and we sought to get this into the revisor's bill, but it only corrects errors, erroneous material in the tax statutes. This is not erroneous. It's just unclear. And so this just went a little bit beyond what they wanted to put in that revisor's bill, and that's why we're bringing it to you today.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Senator Brashear.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just puzzled. Why would a piece of land that was in forest production no longer be in forest production? What is that criteria?
Chair Haas, Senator Bearsugar, there are requirements that you have to meet in order to stay in the forest land designation. A big one that often people will get will be disqualified for is that they're not meeting the stocking requirements for the forest land. So maybe they, you know, they've cut their trees, but they didn't plant new trees. You don't get to continue to stay into the program unless you plant new trees. Now, if you have at least 20% of your land, and I'm getting a little out of my depth here, but if you get at least 20% of your land still has some trees on it and you agree to a planting plan, we can keep you in the program for, I think, up to 5 years, maybe. Again, not exactly certain on that, but you know, we'll work with folks. And then often when this land is disqualified, it'll be qualified under another statute. So it might be put in under, it'll be rolled over into another special assessment program. So maybe for habitat or something like that.
I'm just puzzled because in Oregon, because of the Forest Practices Act, you have to stock. You have to have trees actively growing within 2 years that's it. You have to. So I don't know how you unhave to and then get kicked out of the assessment.
People don't always follow the law.
No, you have to.
I'm just telling you, they don't. He's absolutely correct. I can drive through my district and point to places where, generally speaking, in my observation, at least in my district, it has been a case where person A goes in and buys a 10-acre track. It happens to be in the forestry zoning. They whack down all the trees, they build their house, and they don't replant the trees. And they don't replant the trees for first the 2 years, and then the guy comes out from the forestry and tells them they have to do it, and they send them the basic, you know, one each bureaucrat letter. They still don't do it. And then the assessor comes out, and then they go plant enough trees to get to 20%, and then 5 years later, they haven't, you know, done any of those things. You know, it's just sort of amazing that people that don't follow the law. Of course, that's why we have a criminal code, and it doesn't work either.
Interesting.
And it's not as if there's an abundance of enforcement people in forestry.
That's right, right. Yeah, these guys in my county kind of come out there once every 6 years and say, hey, you didn't get it last time, so you're going to lose it. And it motivates them to try and do something, but then they come out 6 years later and say, you didn't plant this 6 years ago, and now they're going to lose it.
So. Okay. Thank you, Mark.
Certainly.
Committee, are you ready to move this bill, or do you want it to breathe for a while? All right.
This isn't wine. We have no cheese.
Okay.
So just go to work session.
We're in work session.
Are we? Did you open work session? Are we sure we're in work session?
Mm-hmm.
I move HB 2281 to the floor with the due pass.
Senator Boquist moves HB 2281 to the floor of the Oregon Senate with the due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Bechtier.
Yes.
Senator Riley.
Yes.
Senator Taylor.
Aye.
Vice Chair Boquist.
Certainly.
Chair Ass.
Aye. Senator Bertschinger, this is in your wheelhouse.
I'll tell you what, if I carry this bill, everybody would be so confused. They won't know what
I'll carry the bill because I understand it. We'll give Bertschinger a bad bill.
All right, Senator Boquist will carry the bill. Close the public hearing and work session on 2281. Thank you, Kyle. Are you on the next one?
Christina's the
rest. Christina. Open up a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2283. Christina.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2283 is another one of the administrative type bills for the Department of Revenue. And what it does, it provides if a taxpayer elects to apply an overpayment of tax to a subsequent year, the tax installment for that subsequent year, the amount paid is credited as estimated tax on the later of the first estimated tax due date or the date the payment's made. If it's elected on a timely filed return, and or it's credited as an estimated tax on the later of the date return is filed or the date that payment is made, if elected on return filed late, and it applies to any payments made in tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2018. So ORS 316583 essentially assumes that all tax payments occur by April 15th, but this isn't the case. There are about 10,000 returns each year that have payments made after April 15th, but before the return is filed. And so once the return is filed and the tax is calculated, a refund must be issued. If the taxpayer elects to have their refund applied to the next year's estimated tax, the statute requires the Department of Revenue to backdate the refund and to give credit to the taxpayer as of April 15th, even though they didn't have use of the money, the payment wasn't actually made until sometime after April 15th.
We have this colorful chart. Is this on 2283?
Yes.
Yours is colorful, mine's black and white.
No, you need to go through this for us?
Sure, Mr. Chair. The chart just shows some of the timing issues that can happen with the payments, and so essentially the payment here is made on July 1st, and April 15th was the estimated due date for that payment. Current law, the blue line represents the overpayment to apply as of the tax due date in April, even though the payment wasn't actually made until July, and so the orange line represents where that payment would now be credited as of the date that the payment was actually made.
So these are cases where someone paid late, but they overpaid what was owed?
Yes.
And what is the problem with the way it works out that we need to fix?
Mr. Chair, I think the question is that the use of the money is not, the money's not actually received by the state until July 1st, but it's being credited to April 15th and earlier than the payment was actually made, and that's unlike most accounting practices in the world and bill payment type practices. But the Department of Revenue is here to explain it a little
we'll
further.
Pull up Lois Williams, Deanna Mack.
Good
Good morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, Deanna Mack, Department of Revenue, and I have Lois Williams with me here today. She's in training, and we're having her carry these three bills for us today. So I'm just here to back her up and lend moral support.
And I will explain that graphic a little bit more in detail, too. My name, for the record, is Lois Williams with the Oregon Department of Revenue. As Christine explained, Oregon law allows a taxpayer to elect to apply his or her refund to the next tax year rather than receiving the refund directly. Their refund is applied to their account as an estimated tax payment for the next tax year. We call this a refund application, and it's treated as just a payment of their tax. Estimated tax payments are due four times a year. Now, under current law, the payment that a taxpayer makes as a refund of that refund application on a timely filed return is deemed to have been made on April 15th, the first installment due date, without regard to when the payment was actually made. This makes sense if the refund is made before April 15th each year, but crediting a payment that is made after April 15th and backdating it to April 15th goes against generally accepted accounting principles because it doesn't recognize who had use of the money. House Bill 2283 provides that if a taxpayer elects on a timely filed return to apply a refund to their subsequent year estimated tax installment, the refund amount will be credited on the later of that first estimated tax due date or the date their payment was actually made. So on this graphic up here that I have, I think I'll illustrate both how it currently works and how it is proposed to work. The timeline shows calendar year 2017. Just like we're in right now, we're having to take care of last year's tax return now, but we're also having to look ahead to the coming year, 2017. So the top of the line, the green portion, represents all of the activities and the dates that go along with taking care of that last year's tax return, 2016. You'll notice that the original due date says April 15th, and I'll just clarify, that's normally the due date, but whenever the 15th falls on a weekend or a holiday, it gets moved to the next date. So just to be clear, for 2017, the due date is April 18th this year, but in a normal year, it's the 15th. In this example, the taxpayer did file an extension, so they have until October 15th to get their return in, and it will be considered a timely filed return. In July, they make a payment. Perhaps their tax preparer contacts them and says, "Ooh, I think you better make another payment. It will help reduce the amount of interest you're going to owe later on, because I think you're going to owe when we get the return done and you file it." So the taxpayer submits a payment to us on July 1st. The tax preparer finishes the return, and about August 15th in this example, taxpayer comes in, signs it, and files it with the department, and it shows a refund that they got. In fact, that July 1st payment wasn't necessary after all, and the taxpayer is now requesting that their refund be applied to the next year's tax payment. In this example, under current law, that July 1st payment gets credited to them as if they had made it on April 15th, or the first installment due date. Under the proposal, it would be credited as of July 1. Now, this change could affect a taxpayer's underpayment of estimated tax for the next coming year, if they, in fact, underpaid their estimated tax payment. Their payment was due April 15th, but they didn't actually make that payment that resulted in an overpayment until July 1st. Now, current law, because of this situation, it can create an inequity for taxpayers who don't elect to have their refund applied to the next year. They just choose to get their refund directly, but they're also required to make estimated payments. So they got their refund directly sent to them, but they had to make an April 15th payment, or if they had made a July payment, it would not be backdated. So payments are credited in almost all situations when they're actually made, except in this situation. So on average, as Christine said, we find about 10,000 taxpayers who do make these types of late payments after the original due date but before they file their return. So again, this change will align the posting of the payments to when the date was actually made. And we're happy to answer any questions.
Senator Burchard.
So I fully understand this, but it looks like it'll be more likely that a taxpayer will probably incur a penalty in interest on the following tax year because it won't be postdated to the 15th.
Senator Hess and Senator Bart Sugar, that's correct. They will, they could, depending on what other payments they make, they could have an underpayment penalty, which is just an interest on the use of that money during 2017 from when they should have made a payment to when the date was actually applied.
Yeah, well, I've never been very comfortable with making estimated payments where the state gets to use my money all year interest free. And
oh, why not?
Yeah, so I, you know, I've never been comfortable with that philosophy.
I love it.
So this is your bill.
Yeah. This is the one you want me to carry, huh? First, you got to get me to vote for it.
No, this
never stop me to come chair.
What we always say, taxpayer friendly.
Yeah.
User friendly for taxpayers.
Yeah, I don't know.
At least that's always what I say in my floor speeches on bills, on revenue bills that I don't understand.
I do have a question.
No. Senator Buckwitz.
How long has this been a problem?
Yeah.
I'm just curious, you know.
Chair Hass and Senator Boquist, as long as I think these statutes have been enacted, so many, many decades.
I wish I had enough staff just to sit down and come up with these things. So I came up with dueling in 2005 and sat on my desk.
Dueling. This was there around dueling. This is, we're going to fix dueling and we're going to fix this.
I think dueling's been around longer.
Yeah.
I'm looking for the relating clause, and I can suggest you might do that.
So.
Any further questions of the Revenue Department? Okay, thank you. Appreciate you. That chart was very helpful.
And you're welcome.
This was dueling predates taxation.
Okay, thank you, guys. Committee, are we ready to do this one?
Yeah.
Or do you want to let it breathe? All right.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Yeah, okay. I can. I move 2283 to the floor. If it do pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2283 to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a do pass recommendation.
Enthusiastically.
Yeah. Unenthusiastically, but that's okay.
Discussion?
I'm a no. So you're going to call roll.
Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Bedger?
No.
Senator Riley?
Aye.
Senator Taylor?
Aye.
Vice Chair Boquist?
Yes.
Chair Hass?
Hass votes aye. I'll carry it. House Bill 2283 goes to the floor with a do pass recommendation. I'm going to open up a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2284A. Also, Christine.
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2284. Would expand the provisions for the resolution of conflicting claims to taxpayer dependents to include other types of conflicting claims that relate to other items allowed under personal income tax laws. And so this has to do with the sharing of information for items that are common to two different taxpayers' returns and their information that they both have, and they're able to say that they have information from one party to the other party for that, just for that item that they both know about. And so at times the Department of Revenue may receive information from those two different parties, and that relates to that same item of income, deduction, or credit. And the measure allows the department to make a ruling that pertains to both parties from documentation provided by one party. And so it's a bit more efficient for them to process things that way. The measure has a minimal fiscal impact statement and no revenue impact.
Hmm. All right. Let's see if we can find Lois Williams and Dana Mack. Oh,
thank you. For the record, again, my name is Lois Williams with the Oregon Department of Revenue. Christine explained very well that House Bill 8824 expands provisions that are currently in the law that relate to two different tax returns who are claiming the same dependent. It expands it to other items that also pertain to both individuals who have filed a tax return. Oregon laws state that taxpayer returns filed with the department are confidential, with very few exceptions. And the department takes those confidentiality provisions extremely seriously. Violating them does subject us to felony penalties and would also impact taxpayer confidence in our voluntary compliance system. However, confidentiality provisions sometimes impede our ability to perform our work efficiently, especially in cases where taxpayers do have that connected or related item of income or deduction, but who file separate returns. Two very common examples of this situation are, one, married taxpayers who choose to file separately and say they both itemize their deductions, or one itemizes and one doesn't, which under the Internal Revenue Code, they're not supposed to do that. Another situation is taxpayers who pay or receive alimony or child support between them. So sometimes this is ineffective for not only the state, but also for the taxpayer that has to provide information we may already have because we cannot reveal it for fear of coming up against those felony penalties for disclosing. It would be more convenient for everyone involved to be able to acknowledge that we received a copy of a divorce decree, for example, as part of an audit from one taxpayer to the second taxpayer involved in the divorce. We don't need to disclose whether or by how much we may have adjusted the first person's tax return, but just that that information was obtained during the course of the audit that affects the secondary person's return. And, of course, the secondary person would have the ability to provide additional relevant information. The IRS does have a similar provision that allows for one of their Internal Revenue officers to share this type of information in cases where it has determined that it's related to the correct determination of tax, liability for tax, or the amount to be collected. Amendments were requested and made on the House side merely to update wording to more commonly used terms, such as using persons in place of claimants. So we usually talk about persons filing tax returns, not claimants. So in summary, we're asking for changes in ORS 305-215 to remove the current procedural requirements that are outdated relating to those dependency claims that are made by two different people, to broaden it to the types of collateral audit issues that we see more frequently that are shared between taxpayers, similar to what the IRS does. And we're happy to answer questions on this one.
Okay. I do appreciate the more human touch of persons instead of claimants. Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Hess. I'm just looking through here. Maybe it's on here, and I just started looking at it now. But looking at the impact, I assume that this would just bring more money into the state. I mean, you must be doing this because you think that folks are requesting deductions that are being claimed twice.
Chair Hast and Senator Taylor, we don't necessarily know if it would bring in more money. This is more an efficiency of just how we communicate and conduct our work with taxpayers. For example, the fact that we have to disclose a divorce decree to another party may not result in an adjustment to that tax return. Right. It may not. If, for example, two married filing separate taxpayers are both claiming a mortgage deduction for the same mortgage payments, it could result in an adjustment to one tax return or another. But maybe it's an adjustment up for one, an adjustment down for another. So they could be offsetting adjustments. So I don't believe that there is necessarily a revenue impact on this one.
Hmm. Senator Taylor?
Chair Hess, I'm going to go ahead and make a bet that it will be a revenue. I think we'll receive more money coming in. But that's just me guessing.
So we're streamlining. It's
good.
Taxpayer-friendly.
I think it's
good.
Spoken like a true auditor.
I know. I think it's great.
Senator Boquist?
No, I'm a no vote. I'll be happy to make the motion if everybody's happy. Are you okay, Herman?
Do you want to amend it, or you just don't like the?
I don't like it.
Okay.
We're a work session, Mr. Chair?
Yes, we are.
I move House Bill 2284A to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2284A with a do pass recommendation. Discussion? Senator Boquist?
No, I'm a no vote.
Further discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Becker?
No.
Senator Riley?
Aye.
Senator Taylor?
Aye.
Vice Chair Boquist?
No.
Chair Hass?
Aye. House Bill 2284 goes to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. up a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2285.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2285 applies to a specific type of taxpayer. That is...
Senator Taylor will carry that last book, bill. Sorry.
Thank you, Chair.
So it applies to a particular type of taxpayer that this is someone who files a report or return but on an extension but pays less than the full amount of tax due. And currently the tax is assessed on under the measure, the tax is assessed on a later of the original due date of the report or return without regard for extension to the time for filing or the actual date filed. And so currently the amount that's owed is assessed not until the extension or the due date of the extension in October. But this measure would make the tax owed assessed as of the date the return is filed. And so this brings parity between the types of taxpayers who filed an extension and those who did not, because currently they are being there's a difference in the treatment there between those two types of taxpayers. And so the idea is as soon as they file their return that they owe money on that's the date of assessment. Would start at that time, and they wouldn't be able to wait until October. This measure is found to have a no fiscal impact and a minimal revenue impact.
Okay, ladies.
Again, for the record, Lois Williams, Department of Revenue. Thank you, Christine. She did a good job of describing it. House Bill 2285 is a technical change that affects a set of taxpayers with a very specific set of circumstances. They filed an extension by April 15th, giving them until October 15th to file their return. And then sometime between that time, April and October, they do file their return. As soon as it's prepared, as soon as they have it ready, as soon as they have all of the information that they needed, they file it. And they file it showing a tax due. So they have told the department what they calculated their tax at, and it's determined that they owe, and they're telling us that. So currently, when a taxpayer fits this fact pattern, we cannot, by law, issue them a notice of assessment until that October 15th extended filing due date. Sometimes that's months after they actually filed the return. As a result, the department can't begin to take any collection action until after October. And this can cause three problems. The first being that we can't initiate the collection action. And as I'm sure you're aware, the sooner you can contact a taxpayer to work out payment arrangements, the more likely that you have to collect the debt that's owing. Two, many taxpayers are unaware that their unpaid balance continues to accrue interest throughout that extension period. Remember, they got an extension to file their return till October 15th, but their tax was actually due back on April 15th. So by contacting them as soon as possible after they have told us how much they owe will allow us to work with them. They are informed that the sooner they can make the payment, the sooner they can pay the debt. It gives them payment options. And then by statute, the department is also required to add on an additional layer of interest, Tier 2 interest, 60 days after an assessment goes unpaid. So it's an additional higher amount of interest that gets added on. Since these debts don't usually assess, they don't currently assess until after that mid-October extended filing date, Tier 2 interest is not imposed until 60 days later, which is December. So this does create inequities between taxpayers. Two taxpayers can both file their balance due return on the same day, sometime, let's say July 1st. The taxpayer who did not file an extension, obviously they're late, they filed the return late, and those are separate penalties, but the taxpayer who did not file the extension request will have their balance assessed almost immediately. The collection efforts will trigger, we'll contact them, and Tier 2 interest will begin within 60 days if the debt is not paid in full. The taxpayer who did file an extension will not receive a notice of assessment until at least mid-October, will not be contacted for collection, and will not have Tier 2 interest added on until starting in December on any unpaid debt. So the department did ask for a small amendment when the bill was heard in the House Revenue Committee, merely to clarify language, not to change the bill's intent or purpose. Language was changed to remove any perceived ambiguity and make it very clear that for tax due returns filed on extension, tax will be assessed on the later of the due date of the return without regard for extension, or the date the return is filed. Again, it's a timely filed return, but whichever of those is later. In other words, if a taxpayer files their return showing a balance due, even with a valid filing extension sometime between April 15th and October 15th, the tax is assessed on the date that they file their return telling us how much they owe. This does align with how the IRS issues its notices in these situations. We're happy to answer questions.
Questions?
No questions. Don't like it, but I'll probably vote for it.
Senator Boquist?
Just to try and restate this, I think, in short, what we're talking about is an individual asked for an extension and then filed their extension at some date, the extension due date, and it didn't accompany a payment. And so they should have sent a check in within a payment at that time, and they just didn't.
Chair Hass, right? Senator Boquist, you're absolutely correct.
Yeah, okay. You ready, Mr. Chair?
Okay.
What is this bill?
Yeah. It's 2285. You guys are ready.
Mr. Chair, I move 2285A to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2285A with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Beckstrom?
Yes.
Senator Riley?
Aye.
Senator Taylor?
Aye.
Vice Chair Boquist?
Yes.
Chair Hass?
Aye.
Senator Riley will carry the bill.
Close the work session, public hearing on 2285. Thank you, committee, for technical bills. We are out tomorrow, Thursday, so we will adjourn until 8:30 Monday.